Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
You know that feeling when a TV show is just about to end and you find yourself kind of grieving? Like you're missing spending time with these characters. Today on the show, Bill Hader's Barry has quietly been one of the best shows on TV. As a series finale comes closer, we're going to give Barry its flowers. I'm El Amin Abdul Mahmoud. This is Commotion. Listen, this Sunday, people who love and have appreciated the golden era of TV that we're living through are going to be getting ready for the finale of one of the best shows on TV right now. You see what happened there? No, not that one. Not Succession. I am talking about the show that airs right after that one on Sundays.
I'm a good friend. I am a good person. That is who I am. Okay? This is me looking out for you. All right?
Then why are you talking to the feds?
That is a scene with Bill Hader in the show that he created. That is Barry. Listen, it tends to get overshadowed in the prestige TV conversation, but it is very funny and very dark, and it is regularly praised just as this incredible accomplishment. The premise is relatively simple, at least how it started is relatively simple. Barry is a hitman who tries to become a Hollywood actor. It's going to wrap up its fourth and final season the Sunday right after Succession does the same thing. We're going to give Barry some Commotion love, okay? We're going to go into this conversation. We're not going to specifically try to spoil the show, but we are talking about the arc of the show from the first season, which is the one that I've seen, to the fourth, which is the one we're at now. I'm joined by a couple of TV critics who are big fans of Barry. Ben Rosenstock from Vulture and Angie Hahn of The Hollywood Reporter. Ben, Angie, welcome to Commotion, y'all.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Ben, we should say off the top that you've actually seen the finale that's going to air this coming Sunday. Without giving anything away, how satisfied are you with how Barry ends?
I'm really satisfied. I'd say that if you've enjoyed this current season, like the way things are going, interested in the themes and the characters and kind of the directions they're taking, I think it's a really satisfying and fitting end for all the characters.
Andy, one of the news stories that we heard was, you know, they weren't specifically looking to end the show, but as they were writing the fourth season, they kind of stumbled upon this ending that's like, oh, this makes sense as a conclusion to this whole series. So now they're going to end Barry after the fourth season. Do you think they got the timing right?
So, yes. I mean, since I'm a Barry fan, I'm sorry to see it go just because I like checking out these characters every week, but I'm glad it's getting to end on its own terms. It's not a story that I think could kind of drag on indefinitely. Like at some point you run out of ground, you start going in circles, you hit diminishing returns and have to come up with, you know, crazier and more elaborate storylines. I'm sure we've all seen that happen to other shows that we love. So, you know, I think the writers probably, if they had three seasons, if they have five seasons, I'm sure they could have made it work. But the way the fourth season is playing out feels very full, very final. I think it feels about right. It's long enough for the show to have grown and evolved, but not so long that it loses its direction or its momentum.
Ben, what's your vibe on this? Do you agree that it should be ending after the fourth season?
Yeah, I think this seems about right. I think a lot of people thought the third season might be the end, especially, you know, it had this crazy arrest at the very end. It could have just ended there with Barry finally facing accountability and everything. But I think one thing Bill Hader has talked a lot about in interviews is how a lot of this season is about kind of giving the characters what they've always wanted and kind of putting them through that and seeing how they react to it and regress to the worst versions of themselves. So I think that this is the right time. I'm glad we've gotten this final season to explore that material, but I couldn't see it going much longer.
I have to say, Angie, like when before I watched Barry, I think Barry was the pandemic watch for me. That's sort of how I got into it. And I got into it because of the elevator pitch, which is somebody goes, hey, this is the hitman. He's trying to he's no longer interested in killing people. He wants to have a change of careers and he wants to become a Hollywood actor. Getting into it with that premise, I'm curious what you expected from a show like this when you first got into it, but also like the journey that it has taken you on.
I've been watching Barry since it first started airing, and you know what I expected at first was a comedy. You know, obviously comedy with a very dark side and a very violent side, and you know a lot of murders. But yeah. Basically, just a silly little lark about the absurdity of this really intense hitman character deciding that he wants to be, of all things, a Hollywood actor. And season one, I felt like gave me a lot of that. You know, like especially compared to. Especially looking back now from where we've ended up, I looked at season one, and I think that felt almost gentle, you know, despite the violence, like the characters were relatively likable. Like you had characters like NoHo Hank that kind of made you feel like, oh, even in this world where it's all these gangsters that are constantly killing each other, they have this almost cuddly sweet side to them. But you know, then the first season ends on a pretty dark note with Barry killing Janice. And from there, I think there's no going back from that. Like that's the first time that where you really see, like, you know, this guy that's been trying to get out of this life really, really just can't break from it in the way that he needs to be the person that he says he wants to be.
So
and from there, it just, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's exactly like, this is for me, the thing that made me say, you know what, I'm going to return to Barry some other time later, is because I sat down and I watched the first season of Barry probably in a total of 2 days. And I thought, hey, I'm in for this fun comedy. And then it ended on this dark note that I was like, I need to take a moment and maybe come back to the show some other time. And, you know, the fun premise, Ben, of that first season, it ends up sort of having all of these consequences because, yes, Barry is this thriller about assassins and drug cartels, but is also trying to weave in a satire of Hollywood the satire of people who are trying to make it in Hollywood. What parallels do you think Bill Hader was trying to draw between those two worlds?
Yeah, I think Bill Hader has kind of taken the opportunity to comment on a lot about Hollywood. You know, last season three has a lot of kind of satire of the streaming economy. You know, Sally has this new show that premieres on basically their Netflix equivalent, and it's gone within the day, already taken off the streamer. So there is a lot of that satire. But I think for me, what it comes back to is this theme of performance and storytelling. So pretty much everybody in this cast is always thinking, rationalizing their worst decisions in their head by telling these stories about themselves that typically are not 100% true. And you saw that in season, I think it was two, with Sally telling the story of her abusive marriage and kind of softening it for a more empowering ending that might not have actually occurred. And so I think it comes back to this theme of using acting as a way of telling a story, and it might not actually be the most authentic story, but it can still provide solace to people.
I think there's a real sense, Angie, that Barry enjoys the ambiguity of these characters, right? Barry is supposed to be this hero. He engages in a lot of disturbing behavior. He engages in that pretty much right away. And then there's also some characters are supposed to be really ruthless, but also really lovable.
So I'm on your website right now. Beautiful furniture, by the way. And I'm seeing dining room tables. I'm seeing coffee tables, but not sure how to look for the table that I need. No, it's for Carowin, about 30 kilos, give or take. What I'm thinking is carved wood, stone top, marble maybe. What I'm dealing with is an open floor plan, so it really needs to work on its own merit.
Andy, you mentioned him earlier. NoHo Hank, that's Anthony Carrigan giving that performance. It's truly the performance of a lifetime as this gangster. How have your sympathies shifted, do you think, as you've been watching the show? Have you had to like change who you're rooting for? Are you rooting for anybody at all?
I don't know who I'm rooting for at this point. Maybe nobody. I used to root for Barrymore. You know, he wanted to change. I wanted him to change. He's played by Bill Hader, who is very charismatic. And you see how sad he is and so earnest. And, you know, I think it's human nature to want to empathize with characters like that.
Yeah.
But then over time, he's gone from being kind of pitiable to being utterly loathsome in a good way. I think of it like how when you watch Breaking Bad, you start out kind of feeling for Walter White. And by the end, you're just like, oh, he's just a straight up villain. so I feel like my feelings about Barry have changed. And with NoHo Hank, I mean, one of the things that makes this season so bleak to me is the fact that he has all along, despite the fact that he's a violent gangster, been someone who's very funny and lovable and sweet. He like makes sandwiches for the people that he's about to kill and things like that. And I still enjoy him. But then you see there's a point in this season where he just crosses a point of no return, does something really unforgivable. And then it's just a reminder of like, oh, right, he has been this murderous gangster this whole time.
You do need reminders of like who you're really rooting for. I find this all the time on social media with like people talking about Succession, you know, and like who they're rooting for to take over like after Logan Roy. And the idea that you're rooting for any of these monsters is nuts, you know, like the idea that you sort of like want to champion who they are is nuts. And this is sort of like a very similar vibe. Ben, I do want to talk a little bit about Bill Hader in this particular situation, because yes, Barry is the sort of star vehicle for him, but it's also sort of allowed him to flex other muscles. He's been directing, he's been writing. How has he been doing in terms of the way that he's been kind of rounding out what he's known for?
I think it's been a real accomplishment, especially I think it's around season three was when he started taking on a lot more of the directorial duties. And I think around that time I noticed just how every shot really tells a story. And they're so purposeful. And I think maybe it's because of this, the 30-minute time frame allows him to really juice as much as he can from every image and every sound even. So yeah. I think especially in this new season, he's kind of indulged more in the surreal and dreamlike scenes. And I think that's been really interesting to see how he can use the visuals to unpack these characters' complex psychologies, which wasn't as apparent visually early on.
Andy, we got about 30 seconds left here, but I do want to talk actually about Succession, if you don't mind, which is why do you think Barry doesn't get as much love as a big show like Succession?
I think part of it right now is that Succession is stealing its lunch a little bit. I mean, we only have so many hours in a day to talk about TV as much as we love doing that. Yeah. So there's only so much room to talk about Barry. It's also, you know, it's not zeitgeisty in the same way, which isn't a bad thing necessarily. And it's not the kind of show that inspires a lot of fan theories or has that single driving hook of like, who's going to sit on the Iron Throne or the Waystar CEO chair at the end or whatever. So I feel like those things combined make it so that we're not talking about it this much. But, you know, I still see a lot of great dialogue about it. Like Ben is doing a lot of really great recaps, for example. So people should read those.
People should read those. And I'm gonna do it. I'm going to catch up on everything that I've missed from Barry. Angie, Ben, I appreciate you being here. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was our group chat tribute to Barry. My guests were Ben Rosenstock from Vulture. He was in New York. And Angie Hahn with Hollywood Reporter in Los Angeles. By the way, you can tune in tomorrow to hear Tom Power's interview with Sarah Goldberg. She plays Sally Reed on Barry. The final episode is this Sunday, right after Succession.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Is it due to the rain? Or is she in some pain? She looks physically fine. Guess it's something benign.
That is The Girl is Crying in Her Latte. It is a title track from the 26th album from brothers Ron and Russell Mayle. They're better known as Sparks. And listen, if you don't know Sparks, do yourself a favor. Go find the video for this song right now. I bet you'll probably recognize the woman dancing in that bright yellow suit because it's none other than Cate Blanchett. She's just one famous example of this deeply avid, deeply dedicated, kind of cultish fan base for Sparks. Bjork, Duran Duran, Fred Armisen, Weird Al, all those figures are also big fans. Here's the amazing thing. Sparks have been making music for 55 years now, and they just keep getting more and more popular. Edgar Wright, the guy who made Shaun of the Dead and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, he made a documentary about them. And this summer, Sparks are going to play their first headlining show at the Hollywood Bowl in their hometown of Los Angeles. The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte is out this coming Friday. So I got the chance to speak with author, podcaster, and Sparks superfan Paul Myers about how this strange band became so, so influential. Paul started out by describing the dynamic between the two Sparks brothers.
Well, it's interesting because Ron is the keyboard player and kind of the musical genius of the band. I don't know how much is the music is written by both of them, but definitely I get the sense that Ron is the evil scientist. You know, he sits there. He's got the little Charlie Chaplin mustache, Hitler-esque, if you're being charitable.
Yes.
But he's definitely like what English people call a boffin, you know, the guy who figures out the synthesizers and stuff like that. And Russell, especially at the beginning of the career, was a poodle-haired rock star. You know, but it helps a lot because Russell is the performer. You know, he outwardly sings and he's very demonstrative.
A weird bit of the Sparks mythos is that they are American, but they've always been more popular in the UK than they have been in America. And that's largely in part because of this song. There's so much going on in this song. This town ain't big enough for the both of us. That's a song that went to number 2 in the UK in 1974, but it didn't even chart in the US. Side note, Paul, I know that song from the Faith No More collaboration. Like, that's how I first encountered the song.
Right.
Because they sort of recreated it with Faith No More sometime in the 90s, I think it was.
That's right. Roddy Bottom was a huge fan of Faith No More. Yeah, yeah.
And Faith No More, it's like very sort of Sparks-esque kind of band. You never hear Sparks played alongside other glam rock artists like David Bowie, you know, Roxy Music, Queen, on a classical rock sort of radio station. You don't really, you know, can't really call up a rock DJ and say, hey, man, can you play some Sparks today? Why do you think they've been shut out of the canon?
First, by the way, I just want to say the first thing most people hear ask me about Sparks is, you mean those guys aren't English? They're surprised that these are two Los Angeles-raised guys who basically formed at UCLA Film School. And that might be a clue, by the way, is that you heard the Western sound effects in this town. They are definitely a very filmic band, a very cinematic band, and they're way too smart for their own good. And so people who like that sort of thing, hello, me, I love smart bands. I love that they're beat. Like, they rock, but they also have something else there if you want it. Arch lyrics, all these things. But that stuff is baggage as far as commerciality is concerned.
Right.
Someone like Queen could do it, but Queen really pushed the rock end of it. So they would have, you know, We Are the Champions, but We Will Rock You is definitely, you know,
carrying,
a band like Queen could tread the same. And there's also that, I don't know if it's, I don't want to say full-blown homophobia, but there was a kind of an uneasiness in the sort of macho posturing world of the 70s to have somebody who sounded flamboyant on top of that. And he's very English sounding, foppish almost.
Yeah.
And so I think that there is definitely a little bit of the same sort of resistance that came to like the disco sucks movement or something, which is a whole other conversation we'll have someday.
But let's get to the electronic music part of this conversation, because it is one thing, right, to have this career where you are an influential rock band. But then, you know, you get to 1979, Sparks put out this record, which made them instant icons in the world of electronic music that's just kind of beginning at the time. That's Tryouts for the Human Race. It's from Sparks' album from 1979. It's called Number One in Heaven. Paul, like, a lot of rock bands dabble in disco here and there, right? They put out one song or two songs. But Sparks sort of went in this direction of totally reinventing themselves as an electronic dance band. Tell us a bit about the impact of this record and the way that it sort of changed pop music.
Well, let's go back to where they were going, because in 79, they hook up with producer Giorgio Moroder, who had made huge hits for Donna Summer. And I don't know if anyone knows this, but David Bowie and Brian Eno both cited Donna Summer's I Feel Love as the future of music because it was had that electronic insistence to it. And it was
it's a perfect song, and it's
fresh today, even though you know, it was called futuristic then. It still sounds like the future now, which 100%. Is crazy.
I agreed.
Yeah. And so Sparks, being smart guys, they pretty much exhausted their sort of art rock sound. And they were looking for something new. And they just latched on to Giorgio. And that was a shockwave. And in England, where the club culture was always a little more, it was always a lot easier in Britain for rock people to go to clubs than, you know, like I mentioned, the disco sex thing in America.
Yeah.
Well, that thing ghettoized dance music for a certain generation of listeners of rock, but not in Britain. Mm. So again, Sparks, these two American guys have their huge following in Europe because of this.
Yeah.
And they influenced Erasure. I'm sure Depeche Mode owe a little bit to them. And all those bands that had that sound. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, and then generations later. So it was very influential.
The idea of it influencing, having an influence on generations and generations of music later, really stuck out to me watching that Edgar Wright documentary because, and you sort of like blink and you miss it, but there's this moment where someone says, "Hey, all of pop music is just sort of copying Sparks," and that someone is Jack Antonoff, who goes on to become Taylor Swift's producer for the last four or five records. Or so. Like you hear that influence in the sense that this is how someone is thinking about pop music and then producing one of the biggest pop acts that we have right now. So there's something about the fact that they have this deep influence. They've influenced everyone and then we don't talk about them nearly enough. Why do you think that is?
That whole movie that Edgar Wright did about them, you learn so much about who likes them and you learn so much about what they like, but you don't learn about them. And I love Edgar Wright. I think he's a really great filmmaker and I think he did a great job paying tribute to the Sparks aura. Yeah. But did you learn anything about their private life?
No.
They are like water. They move like water. They just are. There's no there for some people. There is a persona. And we love the persona, and I'm a huge Sparks fan.
Yeah.
But there's no sense of what is it to be a Sparks. Like and I think that's a very interesting thing. They're kind of ghosts in the machine that
way. But I think like to me, that doesn't answer the question why they're becoming more popular. What do you think explains that?
Persistence. They have just never stopped. They just don't go away. And every time they've like a snowball, they're gathering a different generation. So now there's a nation of Sparks, you know, multi-generational. When they play the Hollywood Bowl, it's not only a homecoming for Sparks, but it's kind of it's probably the place to be for every Sparks fan on the planet.
Right.
You know?
I have to imagine someone is listening to this conversation who has heard a Sparks song here and there and goes, listen, I can't get into it. His voice is too much for me. The arrangements are too much for me. Everything is so manic. What advice do you have for that person in terms of how they can train themselves to just kind of settle in and listen to some Sparks?
Okay, two things, the music and the lyrics. I would say the approach to the lyrics is they're in on the joke. If you think they're being arch or funny, they know that. They are and they don't care about rock posturing, but they do care about things. And if you listen closely, you'll hear what they're complaining about. But musically, it's so packed with melody. It's so packed with visceral energy, like whether it's rock guitars or incessant drum beats and synthesizer blips. But at the same time, the chords and the chord shifts are like, you know, Euro opera. And they are so rich in musical. So if you just listen closely to the music first, latch on to something, you know, hold on as fast as you can, because they're gonna drag you through the mud. They're gonna take you everywhere. That makes them relevant also because they are everything all everywhere all at once. So
Paul, I appreciate you being here. I appreciate this guided tour to Sparks. I think if people listening to this will have a place to start. So thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
As good as they say it is, that's the way it is. I wish I'd known beforehand. I was born just 22 hours ago, but I want to go back to my former quarters.
As brand new music from Sparks, that is called Nothing Is As Good As They Say It Is. Before that, you heard my conversation with writer and podcaster Paul Myers. By the way, Sparks' 26th album, The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte, is out this Friday.
Sparks to have just one Canadian date on their tour. That is July 3rd in Toronto. And that is the commotion for today. My name is Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud. I'm going to be back here tomorrow. We're going to talk about a whole bunch about the best books coming out this summer. So, I'll see you then.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.